My name is Velocity Child. Every Thursday at the stroke of midnight, step into the parlor of Fallen Woman, a weekly soiree of artists on the fringe with underground thoughts and voices shared with uncensored abandon through provocative opinions, seductive humor, candor, and song. Welcome to Fallen Woman, Velocity Child here. Tonight's a special storytelling edition. And the first story we're going to begin with is called Blood Daddy. Once upon a time, there was a little girl named Melanie. And she was very bad. And every time that she was bad, she would get a spanking. And every time she was going to get a spanking, she was asked to go fetch the belt from the closet. Mother was working hard and wasn't home. Daddy was a writer and staying home. He was Melanie's disciplinarian. So one day she was in trouble again, and she went to the closet and she found the belt that he wanted. When she was across his lap and the spanking began with the whipping, she was no longer in her body and on top of the ceiling, looking down upon herself, being spanked and belted and some extra behavior with his fingers. She was violated. Not too fun at 3 and 4 and 5 years old. So she left her body and watched from the ceiling down below, over and over and over again. One day, she was on the ceiling and she was watching from above, and a voice came to her and said, "You don't have to do this, you know." And of course, Melanie said, "What do you mean?" And then the voice said, "Well, you can do this." And it was as if implanted in her brain was a scene from The Miracle Worker, starring Helen Keller, the main character, in her full body throttle when trying to be controlled, she would lash out with her entire body. And for Melanie, on top of the ceiling, next to this voice, she acknowledged this, having never seen the movie, and body slammed, right down into her body. And everything just went black. And then she was on the floor and the bedroom door was slamming shut and she was alone and bewildered. This hadn't ended the same way as it had before. Suddenly, the door flung open and there he stood in all of his Arkansas white trash glory. A blood-stained wife beater in a pair of jeans, pointing to his gut at the scratches and the blood, screaming at the top of his lungs, "Look what you did to me. Look what you did to me. Look what you did to me." To wit, Melanie sat there bewildered on the floor and looked down at her fingernails and saw the blood and the tissue under her kitten claws and could still taste the metallic penny-like taste of blood in her mouth and saw how frightened he was standing there pointing at his gut in the doorway. And then she laughed her fucking ass off. And then, in absolute terror, he slammed the door. And he never touched her again. And now, we are going to read a story from Barbara Tree Walker, known as Princess Kista, that goes a bit like this. Once upon a time, there was a young princess named Kista. She grew up in a castle with her mother, the queen, and her father, the king. Unfortunately, while Kista was still in her teens, her mother became sick and died. The grief-stricken king banished all the wise women who had tried in vain to cure his wife's illness. Then he plunged himself into affairs of the state, ignoring Princess Kista and becoming more and more ruthless in his pursuit of glory for his kingdom. He began to make war on neighboring kingdoms, to seize more territory, and to destroy rivals. Within a few years' time, he had become a cruel despot. Princess Kista could hardly recognize him, and she grieved for the father she had once known. He seemed to have gone mad. As the king's displeasure brought terrible punishments, his fearful courtiers and servants all followed the king's lead in neglecting his daughter. Poor Kista was reduced to the status of an unpaid housekeeper. Her personal maid was fired. Her once splendid dresses became shabby. The white stallion that she once loved to ride was taken from her and given to one of the king's generals. She was forced to serve meals to her father's knights, a rowdy collection of ruffians who pawed, pulled at her hair, spat on her skirts, and made her the butt of crude jokes. The nastiest of the knights, the king's champion, often hinted that she would soon become his personal plaything. When she could manage to take time away from chores in the kitchen and scullery, Kista sometimes left the castle and went to a certain grove that she had loved since her childhood, a place said to be the haunt of fairies. It was a mossy mound surrounded by a thicket of willows whose lacy branches drooped like curtains around it. In the center of the mound stood a large upright stone that the peasants whispered about, saying that it had been a sacred elder race and was imbued with mysterious powers. Kista never feared the magic stone. She liked to sit and lean her back against its sun-warmed roughness, feeling it as a support and a comfort. One day, When she was resting in the grove, she suddenly felt overwhelmed by the hopelessness and helplessness of her position. She began to cry bitterly, beating her fists against the upright stone. After a time, she heard a small rustling sound. She opened her eyes to see standing before her a beautiful lady in a shimmering silver gown. "Why do you weep?" the lady asked. "I am very unhappy," Kesta said. "My mother is dead, and my father has become a tyrant who treats me like the lowest of his servants. The knights harass me, and I think my father will soon give me to the fiercest and meanest of them as a reward for his battlefield slaughterings." "Then you must run away," the lady said. A pang of fear touched Kesta's heart. "But the castle is the only home I've ever had," she protested. "I have nowhere else to go. I have no money or possessions. I would starve to death wandering the roads as an outcast." "Do not be afraid," the lady said. "You are destined to undergo 3 trials before your rightful place in the world. Your present life is the first. Now it's time for you to move on." From the silvery folds of her gown, the lady withdrew an object the size of a child's fist and placed it in Kesta's hands. It was a cowrie shell with a round, polished back and a front somewhat resembling a wide, slightly grinning mouth lined with small teeth. "Here is an amulet to protect you. Listen to the sea's voice and be guided," the lady said. Kesta put the cowrie mouth to her ear and heard the faraway murmur of the ocean. "Must I go to the seacoast then?" she asked. The lady made no answer. She only smiled, gently touched Kesta's forehead with her finger. Then her outlines grew fainter and fainter until she seemed to fade away into a dazzle of mist absorbed by the sunlight. "Surely," Kesta said to herself, "I am favored by the fairy queen who came to me in person. How can I not obey her instruction?" Later that evening, Kesta made a bundle of her few shabby clothes, took food and knife from the kitchen, stole a warm cloak that one of the knights had carelessly thrown aside, and crept unseen out of the castle. The full moon lighted the roadway before her. She ran as fast as she could until she was deep into the forest. Then she slowed to catch her breath. She walked all night in the direction of the seacoast. At dawn, she lay down behind a haystack in an open field and slept. During subsequent nights, she traveled on foot in the same way, hiding during daylight hours, avoiding passerby towns and lighted dwellings. Her feet blistered, bled, and eventually toughened. When she ran out of food, she stole fruit from orchards, eggs from hen houses, bacon from smokehouses, and other provisions from sleeping farmsteads. Her solitary gypsy life made her alert, resourceful, but she was lonely and always afraid of being discovered and dragged back to face her father's wrath. When she came to the seacoast, she listened to her cowrie shell. It said, "Here, here, here." She sat down on the beach, leaned against a fishing boat drawn up and above the tide line, and fell asleep. The next thing she knew, a hand was shaking her shoulder. She looked up and saw a handsome, curly-haired young man with a coil of rope over his shoulder and a boat hook in his hand. You're sleeping on my boat, he said. I have to launch now. Go home and be lazy there. I have no home, she murmured. Where did you come from, he asked. From somewhere inland, she said. I don't know. You don't know much, do you? He snorted. Well, maybe I can use you. Are you any good with nets? My nets need mending, and I can't handle everything by myself. I can sew and weave rope, said Princess Kesta. All right, see what you can do with this. He pulled a large net from his boat and spread it on the sand. If it's well mended, when I come back ashore, I'll give you good fish dinner. The young fisherman launched his boat and rowed away toward the horizon, leaving Kesta to pull together the broken meshes of his net. Though she was weary from walking, she worked all day under the hot sun. But late afternoon, her fingers were stiff, and she was hungry, thirsty, and gritty with sand. The fisherman returned with a small net full of fish, saying that he needed his large net to catch more. He seemed pleased with Kesta's repair work. True to his word, he took her to his little cottage behind the dunes and cooked her a fine meal of fresh fish, oat bread, and apple pudding. She ate ravenously. Watching her, the fisherman asked, "You haven't had much to eat lately, have you?" "No," Kesta answered, gobbling the last spoonful of pudding. "If you have no home, you could stay with me," he offered. "I could give you food and a roof over your head. You can keep my house, mend my nets, and maybe even warm my bed for me." He gave her an impish grin that made his cheeks dimple and his eyes sparkle attractively. "You're not bad looking, you know." Kesta felt drawn to him. "You're not bad looking either," she said. "Maybe I'll stay for a while." She lived with the young fisherman and soon convinced herself that she loved him. For a while, they were a happy couple, rejoicing in each other's company. Princess Kesta thought she had never seen or had ever been so content in her castle as she was in the fisherman's cottage. But things began to go wrong. Autumn storms were unusually violent, and the school of fish deserted their regular feeding grounds day after day. The young fishermen went out to sea for longer hours, returning only with a sparse catch. There were fewer fish to eat and fewer to sell. Still, the king's tax collectors came regularly for their accustomed tribute and would take nothing less. Kesta and her fishermen had to sell some furniture and dishes to meet the demands. The cottage became less comfortable. "If I were on a throne instead of my greedy father," Kesta thought to herself, "I would have more mercy on the poor people." The young fisherman no longer laughed and smiled with her. All of the merriment went out of him. He told grimly, but fell more and more in debt. Kesta suggested that he give up fishing and try some other line of work. At this, he flew into a rage and slapped her, shouting that he was and would always be a fisherman like his father and his father's father before him. Well, as time went on, he became more surly and morose. On several other occasions, he struck Kesta, blaming her for his bad luck, hinting that she might cast an evil spell on fishing. "That's ridiculous," she protested. "I'm not responsible for your troubles. The king's oppressive government is." But because the fisherman dared not strike out or shout at the armed men who came for the tribute, he took his rage on poor Kesta. Soon she was living in fear again, slavishly hoping each day that he would catch enough fish to keep him from beating her when he returned from the sea. Sometimes when he was gone, she would walk to the dunes in the wintry wind, weeping and bewailing her fate. One misty morning in the dunes, she saw again the lady in the silver gown. "Why do you weep?" the lady asked. "Alas," said Kesta, "I'm worse off than before. Now I am a servant of a man who has no gentlemanly manners at all, and who abuses me whenever life frustrates him. How much lower can I fall?" "Then you must run away," the lady said. "I can't live on the open road in winter," Kesta cried. "If I don't freeze, I'll starve." "Trust your destiny," said the lady. "Listen to your amulet. This is your second trial." Then she disappeared into the mist. Kesta went back to the cottage and put her cowrie shell upon her ear. It whispered, "South, south, 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 south." So before the fisherman could return and stop her, she gathered up her clothing, her knife, some provisions, all the money she could find, and a good pair of boots. She left the cottage, heading southward along the coast. Fortunately, the weather was not bitter cold. She was able to find shelter in empty barns, shed, or shepherds, huts even. After traveling a long way, she came to a town where large ships put in a busy dock. Her weary feet brought her to a waterfront inn. She found the warm, welcoming firelight and the smell of hot food irresistibly alluring. The innkeeper looked at her shabby clothes and snapped, "No beggars allowed in here." "I'm not a beggar," Kesta said indignantly. "I have money." Well, she displayed a few coins, and the man grudgingly gave her a piece of bread and a bowl of hot, thick soup. It seemed the most delicious thing she had ever tasted. When she finished, she asked the innkeeper if he knew anyone in need of a willing worker. "You want to work?" he said. "We need a maid right here. A penny a day, free lodging and all the soup you can eat. But you better not be afraid of hard work." Princess Kesta assured him she was not afraid of hard work and took the job at the inn. She was given an apron, a broom, and a tiny bedroom up under the eaves. All that winter she worked long days, serving customers, making and remaking beds, cleaning rooms, doing laundry, scrubbing floors, washing dishes, helping the cook, and running errands. Her once pretty hands became rough and raw. Her back and legs often ached, and when she fell into her narrow bed every night, she was exhausted. But she was content being supportive of herself. Frequently, men sought her favors and hinted that they could relieve her of her drudgery, but she rebuffed them all, wishing only to be left alone. One flower-scented evening in spring, however, there came to the inn a young man who aroused Kesta's interest. He was a musician. He played his guitar and sang sweet, plaintive ballads for the customers, who came from miles around just to hear him. The innkeeper was delighted by such volume of business and invited the musician to stay on and give regular performances for a while. The musician agreed and was lodged on the floor below Kesta's garret. Sometimes at night she could hear him quietly practicing. Kesta came to know the musician as an easygoing person with a ready smile and a gentle manner. She succumbed to his soft charm, telling herself that a man so sweet-natured would never turn brutish or violent as the fisherman had. She undertook to do the musician special favors, to wash and press his costumes, polish his boots, darn his socks, and save him tidbits from the kitchen, all out of what she thought was love. When the musician decided to move on, she went with him. They were happy together, free as birds, traveling from town to town, earning money through their music. Kesta learned to play the guitar and to sing duets with him. They performed together for weddings, birthday parties, country fairs, well dressings, and festivals. They were invited to stay at inns, manor houses, farms, and community centers. For a while, Kesta enjoyed life. She didn't mind having to do all the practical work while her gentle musician did nothing but sing or sat drinking wine and telling stories to his admirers. As time went on, however, she became increasingly irritated by his happy-go-lucky ways. He was never ill-tempered or impatient, but sometimes he was too indolent or too drunk to bother fulfilling one or another of his engagements. The word got around that he was not reliable. People became less eager for his services. Kesta worked harder and harder, creating new costumes, arranging bookings, collecting a crowd, making excuses for him when he was too drunk to perform. Sometimes she had to do an entire show by herself. She wasn't as accomplished a singer as he was, so her audience were disappointed. In addition, people had less and less money to spend on frivolities like music due to the ever heavier taxes imposed by the king to support his war. In vain, Kesta tried to keep the musician away from the wine and to hearten him to work more. He only smiled sweetly, kissed her, and went off to the tavern. He drank up most of their profits. Kesta was especially concerned because she knew that she would soon become a mother. The responsibility of caring for a child seemed to make no impression whatever on her idol musician. He was drunk when her baby son was born, and he was drunk most of the time afterward. He liked to play with the baby and sing lullabies, but he never helped with parental chores. Now that Kesta was preoccupied with looking after the child, she couldn't look after the musician's career as she had before. The audience grew thinner and thinner and thinner. The musician didn't seem to care whether he performed or not. He spent hours each day doing nothing at all. Kesta grew angry and berated him for his indolence. He didn't mind. He only smiled, petted her, whispered soothing love words, and fell asleep. They were living in a tent on the outskirts of town where the musician had already worn out his welcome. Nevertheless, he went off into the tavern and left Kesta alone with her baby. She sometimes wrapped up the child against the chill and went forth to walk the roads, begging a few coins from passerbys and keeping herself warm by moving briskly. One day, on a lonely roadside, she found herself weeping uncontrollably onto her baby's hood. When she looked up, she saw the silver-gowned lady again standing before her. "Why do you weep?" the lady asked. "I am penniless," said Kesta. "And though the musician is gentle and kind, he is as irresponsible as this child here. I can't live like this." "Then you must run away," the lady said. "How can I care for my child as a homeless beggar?" Kesta cried. "At least now he has a roof over his head, even if it is only a tent." "You have passed through your third trial," the lady said. "It is time for you to remember that you are a princess. You have learned enough about your people. You know how weary they are of oppression and welfare and warfare. Instead of singing to them, you must tell them the things they need to hear." And then she disappeared. Kesta went back to the tent and listened to her cowrie shell. It whispered, "Speak, speak, speak." She packed up all her belongings and went to the next town. There she used the skills she had learned to gather a crowd with music and song. Instead of entertaining, however, she made a speech. She told the people who she was and how she thought the government should be run. They cheered her beautiful words. Afterwards, a tall, rangy man in forester's clothing came to see her. He said he could gather an army of outlaws who were eager to overthrow the king, but needed a legitimate heir to enthrone in his place. He proposed that Kesta place herself at the head of this army and help prepare a people's revolution. Kesta agreed. She accompanied a growing ragtag army around the countryside, preaching her vision of a peaceful, equal people's government. She became known to all as Queen Kesta. She created a flag showing a golden cowrie shell on a background of royal blue. Peasants flocked to her standard. As it happened, the king had become ill and could no longer look after his affairs. Thinking that he had no heir, his rowdy knights were fighting among themselves for a chance at the succession. The government was neglected and corrupt, worse than ever. For such reasons, peasants and villagers were glad to join Queen Kesta's army in the hope of better living conditions for themselves and their families. When the outlaws finally completed their preparations and marched on the king's castle, the king was on his deathbed. The knights were demoralized by the sight of an army so huge that it seemed to spread to the horizon on every side. Some of the knights who had been guilty of especially cruel oppressions and feared retaliation crept out of the castle by secret gates and ran away. Others put up a token resistance, but in the end of the day, they were forced to surrender. Kesta entered the castle in triumph and faced her dying father, who recognized her and declared that she was the long-lost legitimate heir. She showed him her infant son, who would reign after her, and the old king died somewhat comforted. Queen Kesta had herself crowned twice. Once at a splendid coronation ceremony in the castle, and once with a wreath of wildflowers in the old fairy grove. She established a shrine there and made regular visits to the ancient standing stone. Soon after she ascended the throne, Kesta carried out all the reforms she had promised. She was merciful to the warlike knights, but she took away their lands and castles and made them take up honest trades. She also established strict compulsory reform schools for men who beat women or children. She sent palace guards to seek out offenders and compel them to attend such schools until their habits were changed. A few threats, as of grievous personal injury for non-compliance, went far toward helping such men take their lessons seriously. Queen Kesta was loved by her people. She reigned well for many years and trained the young prince to do likewise. She never took a husband and lived happily ever after. Blessed be. And you were listening to Fallen Woman on Radio Free Brooklyn. I must say, and especially in this day and age, if you like what you hear and you would like to support independent, censorship-free radio, please go to radiofreebrooklyn.com/pledge. And, well, you can pledge as a little as a dollar a month. And that keeps our voices heard. Thank you. And now we have another story I like to call Doctor's Visit. Doctor's Visit. So yes, this one's personal and recent. And it's me. So I'm not going to say once upon a time there was a woman named Velocity. So yes, for those who don't know, I was in a coma for a little while, not that long ago. Long enough, but not that long. And, you know, you suffer muscle atrophy. And so I signed up for this surgery about 2 weeks ago. And, you know, apparently when you have muscle atrophy of a face, your body makes fatty deposits for protective reasons. And I don't want to live with that. I didn't sign up for that, so let's get it out of there. But, you know, I haven't been under anesthesia since the coma. I was a bit nervous. I even asked the doctor, could it be possible to do this surgery without anesthesia? And he said yes. But he followed it up with, oh, but you don't want to do that. Like, it's unpleasant. But don't worry, I'm just putting you under Twilight. Twilight is a mild form of anesthesia, for those who don't know. You can Google it. Anyway, I digress. So, you know, he gives you a mild sedative, pre-Twilight anesthesia to take an hour before you arrive for surgery. I want to say it's Clonidin, but I'm not sure. But it was mild. Trust me. It was far too mild. I digress again. So, okay. Taking the Clonidin, off to surgery, good to go. This, I'll say this much about my veins. I have very thick skin, so before I even was fully sleeved, tattoo-wise, it was always difficult for a doctor to find a proper vein on me, but it has gotten increasingly harder over the years. And recently I realized I think I have something called rolling veins. And here's why I say this. So I've seen this doctor before, albeit 9 years ago. He's just as amazing and skilled. And I warn him about, you know, hey, it's hard to find my veins. You should be aware of that. He didn't quite pay attention. So when I get there, I'm strapped down to the gurney. It's like this hydraulic gurney, and your arms are spread in like Christ-like position, and they strap you down, and they start poking around to find a vein to give you the anesthesia. And it was kind of like I was a voodoo doll, because they just couldn't find the vein. And I'm poked and poked, and there's no anesthesia for that part. And it was quite painful. And I expressed what I said before, and now it's starting to really believe me about my vein situation. And I said, you know, 9 years ago you had a hard time finding my veins, and you did it in my feet. So then he starts stabbing my feet. And if anyone's ever had a tattoo on their feet, they'll know just how sensitive your feet are. So he's stabbing my feet again, more voodoo doll action, feeling like a pincushion. And he's just, and at this point, okay, he's finding my vein. But as he finds the vein, he's just getting ready to insert what he needs to insert. My vein jumps out of the way. Literally leaps out of the way, and he can't get, and that's what rolling veins are. They just They, like, have a mind of their own. You will not capture me. He's so frustrated at this point. He says to me, hey, so remember how you said you might be able to do this without anesthesia? Yeah. And he's like, well, you know, can you do that now? Now, I've never visually watched this surgery online, this procedure I was about to undertake, and I didn't realize what I was about to get myself into. And I just was, there I am, strapped to the gurney, I've taken the pill, and then, you know, I just feel like, let's just do it, man, let's just do it. So I say yes. And as soon as I consent, he is, there's no stopping him. He just dives right in. And we begin the procedure. Now, for those of you who don't understand what chin neck liposuction looks like, I recommend you go on YouTube and look it up. Imagine what that's like, being alert. Well, you can feel that long skinny hacksaw slicing against your jawbone. And here's the thing, I've never been able to wear a turtleneck or a collar or even a choker most of my life. For reasons I'm not going into, but it involves my childhood. Strangulation and being choked or force-fed, things like that. So, that being said, I don't even like to sleep at night with a pillow touching my neck. And I'm wildly ticklish, especially on my neck. So although the local injection kills the pain, it doesn't kill the ticklish vibe. So I'm experiencing all this serial killer hacksaw knife action from the top of my chin to my clavicle bone, side to side on my jaw and all the way down. I have to say this. I'll just stop and say this. Not since I had to be awake for my abortion in 2003 have I felt anything like this. And I have to say, this made my abortion of 2003 that I had to be awake for look like a cakewalk. So there I am. And he's making bad jokes and funny jokes. He's being very politically incorrect, and I'm very happy about it. It's making it easier. But some of the things he said were kosher. Like, really, you don't want to say that to me. Like, he made a joke about almost slicing open my esophagus, at which point I opened my eyes during the moment for the first time, and I actually saw the instrument. It was, like, hovering. It wasn't in my throat at that point. It was just hovering over my face. And I could see the serrated edges of the skinny thing that he was just diving into my throat, like literally between the outer flesh and the inner flesh. And there wasn't much flesh separating it from the esophagus. And it was around that time that he made a joke about accidentally slicing into my esophagus. That he told me that was the only thing I should worry about. And I knew it was a joke at the time. Anyway, and as this is happening, I could feel the fluid splashing out the side of my throat, and then neck, if you will. And then at times, it was cum shotting onto my face. And I was asking him, you know, what's that? And he's like, oh, that's just water. I'm like, that doesn't smell like water. It was very visceral, but I have to say, it was hardly worth it. After certain life events that you have no control over, it's nice to have control over how you feel when you look in the mirror. And I have no regrets. And I would actually do that again if I had to. I mean, the whole time he had Russian disco playing in the background. It was kind of hilarious. And like I said, I'd do it again. And yeah, so that's my recent story. And now I'm going to play you a couple songs. Thank you so much for listening to Fallen Woman on Radio Free Brooklyn tonight. And if you would like to listen to archive episodes, usually I have many guests. Tonight is special. But if you'd like to listen to archive episodes, you can find them at fallenwoman.com. And thank you again so much for listening to my storytelling evening. Sweet dreams, jelly beans.
I am a nasty woman. I'm not as nasty as a man who looks like he bathes in Cheeto dust. A man whose words are a diss. Track to America. Electoral college sanctioned hate speech contaminating this national anthem. I'm not as nasty as Confederate flags being tattooed across my city. Maybe the South actually is gonna rise again. Maybe for some it never really fell. Blacks are still in shackles and graves just for being black. Slavery has been reinterpreted as the prison system in front of people who see melanin as animal skin. I am not as nasty as a swastika painted on a pride flag. And I didn't know devils could be resurrected, but I feel Hitler in these streets. A mustache traded for a toupee. Nazis renamed the cabinet electroconversion therapy, the new gas chamber shaming the gay out of America, turning rainbows into suicide notes. I am not as nasty as racism, fraud, conflict of interest, homophobia, sexual assault, transphobia, white supremacy, misogyny, ignorance, white privilege. I'm not as nasty as using little girls like Pokemon before their bodies have even developed. I am not as nasty as your own daughter being your favorite sex symbol. Like your wet dreams infused with your own genes. But yeah, I'm a nasty woman. A loud, vulgar, proud woman. I'm not nasty like the combo of Trump and Pence being served up to me in my voting booth. I'm nasty like the battles my grandmother fought to get me into that voting booth. I'm nasty like the fight for wage equality. Scarlett Johansson, what were the female actors paid? Less than half of what the male actors earned last year. See, even when we do go into higher paying jobs, our wages are still cut with blades sharpened by testosterone. Why is the work of a black woman and a Hispanic woman worth only 63 and 54 cents of a white man's privileged daughter? This is not a feminist myth. This is inequality. So we are not here to be debunked. We are here to be respected. We are here to be nasty. I'm nasty, like my blood stains on my bed sheets. We don't actually choose if and when to have our periods. Believe me, if we could, some of us would. We don't like throwing away our favorite pairs of underpants. Tell me, why are tampons and pads still taxed when Viagra and Rogaine are not? Is your erection really more than protecting the sacred, messy part of my womanhood? Is the blood stain on my jeans more embarrassing than the thinning of your hair? I know it is hard to look at your own entitlement and privilege. You may be afraid of adding up a few extra cents, it adds up to the pile of change I have yet to see in my country. I can't see, my eyes are too busy praying to my feet, hoping you don't mistake eye contact for wanting physical contact. Have my life. I have been zipping up my smile, hoping you don't think I want to unzip your jeans. I am unafraid to be nasty because I am nasty, like Susan, Elizabeth, Eleanor, Amelia, Rosa, Gloria, Condoleezza, Sonia, Malala, Michelle, Hillary. And our pussies ain't for grabbing. Therefore, reminding you that our balls are stronger than America.
Oh, set the world on fire. That is my one mad desire. I'm a devil in disguise. Got murder in my eyes. Now I could see blood running through the streets. Now I could see blood running through the streets. Could be everybody laying dead right at my feet. Now a man who invented war sure is my friend. A man who invented war sure is my friend. Don't believe that I'm sinking, just look what a hole I'm in. Give me gunpowder, give me dynamite. Give me gunpowder, give me dynamite. Yeah, I'd wreck the city, wanna blow it up tonight. I took my Winchester down off the shelf. I took my Winchester down off the shelf. When I get through shooting, won't be nobody left.